Hey everyone, this is our episode for Friday, June 5th, 2020. Masks, social distancing, and diligent hand washing have become the new norm in the era of COVID-19. But for many, following CDC guidelines to prevent the spread is nearly impossible. That's the case for people in jails, prisons, and detention facilities, which are now understood to be major hotspots for the virus. And that's why advocates, public health officials, and public defenders are calling for decarceration, reducing the number of people held in jails, prisons, and detention facilities as a strategy to flatten the curve and prevent massive outbreaks among people who are already vulnerable to the virus.
The carceral state, the system of mass incarceration, prison industrial complex, whichever name you want to attach to it, is and has been deeply harmful, particularly for poor people, Black people, brown people in this country. And here in the St. Louis region, we've seen that on steroids.
In this episode, we hear from decarceration advocates, the director of the Missouri Public Defender System, and the director of public safety for the city of St. Louis about what can be done to reduce the number of people held in jails, prisons, and detention facilities, what's at stake for public health and public safety if no changes are made, and how courts and jails have shifted their operations during the pandemic. I'm Jialian Yang, and from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. To get a sense for how it feels to be jailed during the pandemic, we're going to start by hearing from someone who is incarcerated in the city of St. Louis.
So my concern is that if nobody does nothing about this, if that stuff gets in here thick, because it's already in here, if it gets in here, ain't nothing we can do. It's going to spread like wildfire. Because we don't have no masks, we don't have no gloves, we don't have none of those things. We don't have enough hand sanitizer to go around. Once it's empty, it takes as hell to get it filled again.
This was recorded in late March on a jail hotline number set up by Arch City Defenders, a St. Louis-based holistic legal advocacy organization. It's an excerpt from one of 10 stories that were released to the public on April 15, 2020 by Arch City Defenders and the Close the Workhouse campaign, an effort to close the city of St. Louis's medium security institution. These stories express concerns by people who are incarcerated in the city of St. Louis about their lack of access to masks, gloves, hand sanitizer, and cleaning supplies, the difficulty of social distancing in close quarters, and their fears of being exposed by correctional officers to the virus. Later in this episode, we'll hear how the Director of Public Safety for the City of St. Louis responds to these concerns. But first, we asked Blake Strode, the Executive Director of Arch City Defenders, to help us understand why local and national decarceration movements have increased in urgency during the pandemic.
What became very clear in the early days of the pandemic is that jails, prisons, detention facilities generally are like petri dishes for this disease. And so we've seen all over the country that when the virus gets into a jail or a prison, and it will get in, it spreads like wildfire, it cannot be contained, and it also poses a public safety risk to people outside of the jail.
Jails, prisons, and detention facilities aren't closed systems, and the people who work in them can spread the virus even when they are asymptomatic.
There are guards who work in the jails. There are people that are going in for all sorts of food services and telecom and other issues. And those people go in and they come back out. And so the families of folks who are touching those facilities, the social networks, the people they're coming into contact with are all at risk.
And that increased public health risk is especially troubling given the demographics represented in St. Louis jails.
Entire swaths of our region, particularly North St. Louis City and increasingly North St. Louis County, have been really devastated by an overreaching system of police, prosecution, and jails. And if you look at our local jail population, you see a gross overrepresentation of Black people, of poor people, of people with mental illnesses in our jail population. It's because we've chosen to criminalize certain folks instead of providing the kinds of resources and supports that we need.
The virus was spreading quickly, so a week before St. Louis City and St. Louis County issued stay-at-home orders, Art City Defenders and other regional organizations released a letter to local and state leaders with policy recommendations to center the needs of those most impacted by the virus. And those recommendations included the call to immediately suspend in-person court operations and release people from jail, with a few exceptions.
With the letter calling on the court to take action, was a letter that was authored by Dr. Fred Rotnick, who is a doctor at and teaching physician at St. Louis University Medical Center. And he's also the former medical head at the St. Louis County Jail. And he authored a letter in which he said, these facilities are not capable of complying with the CDC requirements. They're not capable by their very design and very nature. And this was signed off on by 16 other medical and public health officials, surgeons, practicing, you know, ER doctors, public health PhDs, all saying the same thing, that this is a dangerous situation that can only really be mitigated by releasing more people from the jail.
And with the support of doctors and public health officials in hand, they approached city and county judges and the Missouri Supreme Court.
We've made direct asks to both presiding judges in the city and county to be more aggressive in directing the judges in their circuits to release people pre-trial, release people who have high cash bails, release people on probation violations. And then we took that same call directly to the Missouri Supreme Court. And on March 26th, joined with the public defender and a number of other organizational partners and individual signers, in sending a letter to the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court and other judges of the court to use their authority to actually order circuits around the state to release more folks from jails.
They weren't alone. Advocates were amplifying calls for decarceration efforts across the country.
We have seen examples across the country, from Philadelphia to Chicago to Atlanta. In the Montana, there was an order early on from the Chief Justice of their Supreme Court to order the release of many people from jails across the state. LA, I don't want to leave out, released hundreds of people from their jails.
These decarceration efforts continue an existing movement to release people who are being held simply because they can't afford bail.
This is a national conversation that is playing out in real time. And I think largely what we've seen is identifying people that are unobjectionable, that are easy cases, frankly, that never should have been in jail, that should have been released pre-trial in most cases. That's what we're talking about in jail. Very few here that are serving sentences, most that are being held pre-trial.
But even though people are being released from jail during the pandemic, it's not been enough to prevent outbreaks of the virus.
There are very few examples of places that have been sufficiently aggressive in doing so. And as a result, what you've seen, even in some places that have released people from their jails, in Cook County, which is Chicago, Illinois, is maybe the best example of this. They actually have released a number of people from jails in Cook County, and still it has seen a huge outbreak of COVID-19 in the jails because the population is still too high, the conditions still are not conducive to things like social distancing and effective hygiene practices. And that is inevitably going to be the case in many jails and prisons across the state.
Blake points out that public health officials have discouraged gatherings of people as a way to prevent the spread. But those standards don't seem to apply to St. Louis jails, which still hold hundreds of people in their facilities.
Every person that we can avoid being in jails in this moment reduces the threat of an outbreak in the jails and reduces the threat of that outbreak spreading outside the jails.
And even though conditions experienced by people on the inside affect public health for people on the outside, there's often strong opposition to decarceration efforts.
There are many people who hear discussion of people being released from jails and have an instinctive reaction that is based on fear. And the thing to understand and unpack about that fear is it is engineered. It has been engineered by decades of false messaging about what our criminal legal system is, what it does, who it captures within its grasp. And the truth is that it has always, always been a force that has targeted certain communities, poor people, Black and brown people, people living on the margins, unhoused people, people with mental health issues, people with substance abuse issues, and swept them up en masse. And what we're talking about now is undoing that.
For Blake, reimagining public safety means investing in social services, healthcare, and community accountability, rather than incarceration.
It is already not the case that our current system of policing and jails and prisons prevents us from being subjected to crime, violence, community harm. We see it play out every day. So we know that our current system is failing. Let's try a different way. Let's actually see if we invest in a different set of institutions and a different set of practices, if we have better public safety and public health outcomes. And that has become especially acute in this moment because we're actually facing a public health crisis.
So even though legal services remain a priority for Arch City defenders, they're now leaning into the holistic aspect of their work even more. They've partnered with regional organizations to develop resource and advocacy hubs and strengthen mutual aid efforts.
We always see the kind of direct services and supports as linked to policy advocacy and organizing and systemic change. We know that there's a direct relationship between those two things, and we know it's really important that impacted people be at the center of those organizing and advocacy efforts. We've also created an advocacy hub, stlcovidhub.org, and that is really designed around that March 13th letter with the six categories and calls to action, but it also includes on a sort of running basis, we keep adding other advocacy projects that people can be aware of, that they can get involved in, so that they can push for things like, you know, more shelter for the unhoused, better availability of testing, push for universal healthcare and access to treatment for folks who get sick, more economic supports for folks who are out of work.
What's been carrying him through is the collaboration, creativity, and support that has blossomed in response to the crisis.
The truth is, for many people, we were in a crisis mode before this crisis hit. And a lot of what people are sort of rallying around now in these moments should be applicable well after this present crisis ends.
Local decarceration advocates like Inez Bordeaux and Jay Shepherd are among those who were in crisis mode before the pandemic hit St. Louis. Inez was directly impacted by conditions at the workhouse, having spent 30 days in the jail from March 2016 to April 2016 for technical probation violation.
And I got to see firsthand the horrors that you know people are being subjected to in the workhouse. I got to see firsthand, you know, the rats and the roaches and the mold that grows on the walls and the showers that don't work and the toilets that are always backed up. I got to see the quality of food that the people there are having to eat. I got to see and experience firsthand the mistreatment by the correctional officers there at the workhouse. I got to see the lack of medical care that's being provided to people that are being detained there, people that are mostly Black and mostly poor.
And Jay had relatives who were directly impacted by conditions in Cook County Jail.
Mostly because they were addicts, and one was addicted to alcohol, one crack cocaine. And yeah, they were like, still from my family a lot, my grandparents. And I was like, they don't need to be in jail. They need resources.
Now, they work together on the Close the Workhouse campaign, with Inez as the manager of community collaborations for Arch City Defenders, and Jay as an organizer for Action St. Louis, a grassroots racial justice organization. We interviewed them at the end of April and asked them to tell us about how the campaign to close the workhouse, St. Louis City's medium security institution, began, and how they're supporting people who are incarcerated during the pandemic.
The campaign started back in 2017 when Action St. Louis decided that they were going to participate in what's called the Black Mama Bailout. They crowdsourced funds to bail people out, bail Black mamas out specifically to get them home in time for Mother's Day with their children. And after Action St. Louis bailed a bunch of people out, they kind of started hearing these stories about the conditions of the workhouse. The stories weren't new, because if you are Black in St. Louis, like, you either have been to the workhouse or you know someone who's been in the workhouse. So the stories weren't new, but the stories had just taken on a certain level of just like grotesqueness and danger and harm, and the conditions just seemed so much worse.
Action St. Louis partnered with Arch City Defenders, the Bail Project, and Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment to start the campaign right after St. Louis made national news about jail conditions in the summer of 2017.
People were hanging out of windows, waving towels and shirts and begging for help and complaining of how hot it was inside of the jail. So after all of that happened, these orgs got together and said, we need to start a campaign to close this jail.
The Close the Workhouse campaign was mirrored off similar campaigns to close jails across the country, such as Close Rikers in New York, Close the Jail ATL in Atlanta, and Close the Creek in Philadelphia. And campaign organizers are working together to share strategies about how to press for decarceration during the pandemic.
We know that orgs, just like ours, are petitioning their prosecutors, their AGs, their Supreme Courts to, hey, release as many people as possible to reduce the spread of COVID and flatten the curve. Very, very, very conservative states are saying, yes, let's decarcerate the jails. Let's release as many people from the jails and prisons as possible. And it's just not happening here. I am at a loss for why it is impossible to flatten the curve without decarcerating the jails. The CDC has said so. Every major national org who does this kind of work has come out and said, this is what we have to do to flatten the curve and keep the city safe. And yet our city and even St. Louis County is failing to do that.
As Inez continues to push for decarceration, she's had to help people work through fears around public safety toward a better understanding about how race and class impact whether or not someone ends up in jail.
Getting people to understand that we have all been brainwashed into this idea that if someone is in jail, they are automatically unsafe, they are a danger to the community, that they're this criminal or some person that should be locked away. So the very first thing is explaining to people that the people that are in the workhouse, they're only there because they're poor. They're not there because they're violent offenders. They're not there because they're the scourge of society. They're there because they're poor. That is literally it.
She adds that a vast majority of the people in the workhouse are Black, which is especially concerning given that African Americans make up less than 50% of the people in the city of St. Louis.
This idea that jails and police make us safe is very untrue, especially in St. Louis. You don't have to take our word for it. You can just look at the numbers. If jails and police made us safe, we would be the safest city in this country, since we spend 52% of our general fund budget on what's called public safety. Of that 52% of the general fund budget, 40% of that alone, just alone, is spent on police and jails. We're spending 40% of our budget on police and jails, and yet our crime rates are still high. Our violent crime rates are still high. So, like, the math doesn't add up. So a lot of times when I talk to people about public safety, we have this idea of re-envisioning public safety, re-envisioning what makes us safe. Police don't make us safe. Jails don't make us safe. Things that make us safe are job opportunities for people, robust education that prepares them for jobs of the future. Affordable housing makes us safe. Mental health services make us safe. Having access to affordable childcare is what makes us safe. Those are the things that keep us safe.
In January 2019, Arch City Defenders and national law and civil rights organizations filed a federal class action lawsuit against the city of St. Louis on behalf of four plaintiffs who were denied their right to fair bail hearings. Of those four, three were Black men, and most were caregivers for their family members. They had bonds ranging from $10,000 to $30,000, but they were granted only up to 2 minutes to appear before a judge, so they were unable to explain their inability to pay. And as they waited for their cases to be resolved, they were in jail for 13 to 18 days, during which they said they experienced mold in showers, rodents, and extreme cold, conditions which Dale Glass, St. Louis City's corrections commissioner, disputed at the time. Then, in June 2019, a federal judge issued a preliminary injunction requiring the city of St. Louis to give a fair bail hearing to every person arrested within 48 hours of their arrest, and a hearing within 1 week to all those who are being held in jail awaiting trial. But a federal class action lawsuit that Arch City defenders filed against the city of St. Louis on behalf of seven plaintiffs about unsanitary and dangerous conditions at the workhouse back in 2017 is still pending. It alleges the presence of mold, mice, roaches, and spiders in the jail, in addition to extreme heat, denial of medical care, and correctional officers instigating sexual harassment and violence. The pandemic adds yet another layer of concern to the conditions at the workhouse and the St. Louis City Justice Center, also known as CJC.
The lawyers at Arch City Defenders wanted to get more information because this directly ties into the conditions lawsuit. If people are continuing to be held in unconstitutional, inhumane, horrific conditions, like, the lawyers want to know about it. They put together a hotline that people can call to let us know what they're experiencing inside of the workhouse, where family members could reach out and let us know what their family members are dealing with, not just the workhouse, but CJC. So those calls, once we published the numbers, the calls just started rolling in. The lawyers have spoken to dozens of people who are being held inside of CJC and the workhouse.
Several stories from those calls have made it to the public SoundCloud playlist entitled #DecarcerateSTL, Caged During COVID-19, Stories from the Inside, including the excerpt we shared at the top of the show.
The way to affect change is through the storytelling. People need to hear the words of the people who are living through this, who are living through this trauma, who are living through these inhumane conditions. That's the only way things truly move, is if people hear those stories.
In the meanwhile, Inez and Jay want to know how the city of St. Louis will respond to the pandemic, and if that response includes decarceration.
People have the right to fight their cases. People have the right to fight their cases from home. In that regard, our mission hasn't changed. It's still to empty out the jails as much as possible. But then we want the city to release an actual plan, something that we can go to. We want to know what the policies and procedures are. We want to know that they are emptying the jails as much as possible. Like, we want to know, what is the plan?
In the meanwhile, Inez and Jay want to know how the city of St. Louis will respond to the pandemic, and if that response includes decarceration.
I feel angry that we're caging 113 people, and that's a public safety risk. Like, we are setting them up.
I'm angry all the time. I tell people all the time, like, I'm angry. Every single day when I wake up, anger is what gets me out of the bed in the morning. Anger is what motivates me. And that's been true for a very long time, many years at this point. Like, I'm always angry. And so when I think about those 113 people that are in the workhouse that really don't have to be, that they're there just because they're poor, I get angry all over again. And that gives me that motivation and drive to, you know, tweet the mayor or call the mayor or, you know, whomever needs to be called. So anger is how I'm getting through. Anger is a renewable energy source. It's renewable.
for people to be released from jails, prisons, and detention facilities, certain legal proceedings are still required, even as court procedures must shift due to the pandemic. It's been almost a month since we last interviewed Jay and Inez, and the city of St. Louis has responded to the pandemic by changing policies in its jails. So up next, we hear from the director of the Missouri State Public Defender System about what can be done to reduce the number of people who are incarcerated. And we talk to the director of public safety for the city of St. Louis for the city's response to stories about conditions in city jails during the pandemic. Arguments for decarceration have existed for years, and the pandemic has amplified existing concerns over health conditions in jails. But releasing people from jail and figuring out how to provide the resources and supports needed to prevent recidivism or violations from happening in the first place is easier said than done, something Mary Fox knows firsthand as someone who has close to two decades of experience in St. Louis area public defender systems.
I have always been an attorney for the underdog, and that is who our clients are in the public defender system. So that is just, that is the work that has called me and that I've enjoyed throughout my career.
We spoke to Fox, the director of the Missouri State Public Defender System, on May 11th, a week before shelter-in-place orders were lifted in St. Louis City and County, about how her work as a public defender has shifted in the pandemic and what policies and procedures are involved in decarceration.
Even though even though the courts have shut down, there are 600 employees in the public defender system, and during the course of any year, about 50 to 60,000 clients. People don't think of public defenders as first responders, but in essence, we are, because as people are being arrested and come to jail, and telling the court that they are poor and cannot afford an attorney, we still need to be present to find out if that person qualifies for public defender services. And if they do, to then represent them. So we've been spending this time continuing to take applications, open cases, talk with clients, appear in court, and prepare our cases. So we've been busy during all of this time. We've just been learning how to do it in different ways.
Providing clients with legal services under shelter-in-place orders has meant adjusting to remote court proceedings whenever possible.
It's a difficult line to walk because as a defense attorney, I want to be in court with my client in front of the judge so that I can make whatever sort of appeal I need to make personally to the judge. And I want the judge to see my client. It's one thing to see us over these computers that we've gotten used to over these last 6 or 8 weeks, but it's not the same as seeing the person in front of you in flesh and blood. So moving forward, there's definitely room to increase remote proceedings or proceedings by video conference, but we have to make certain that we don't increase them for our convenience at the cost of our clients' constitutional rights.
Meanwhile, efforts to stop the spread of COVID-19 have forced several changes that Fox hopes will continue past the pandemic. Releasing people from jails is one of them.
As I said, judges took a look and said, you know what? This person isn't really dangerous. They don't need to be in jail. Let's get them out of jail.
Issuing summons releases rather than arrest warrants is another.
And that means the person who is being charged is being told, come back to court on this day. They don't have to go to jail. They don't have to make bond. But they do have to come back to court when they have a court date.
And concerns over COVID-19 have reduced the number of times police pull people over, resulting in fewer unconstitutional stops and fewer cases being issued.
A lot of times you will see cases where a person is driving down the street and the police officer says they pulled them over because the person made a right-hand turn without using their blinker. And therefore, that's a traffic violation, pull them over, and then they do a search and there's guns or drugs. How many times have you made a right-hand turn without using your blinker? So I can tell you I have many times and I have never been pulled over by a police officer. So what that tells me is the police officer isn't pulling them over because they made a right-hand turn without using their blinker. The police officer pulled them over because they were a minority and the police wanted to search the car or them. and see what they could find and see if they could make a case against the person. In times like this, because the police are as concerned about their own personal safety as everyone else is concerned about their safety coming into contact with people, there's fewer of those stops happening. And I don't think there has been an increase in crime during this time period. So we have more people on the street and we have fewer of those stops and we have people being released on summons release, but crime is not going up. So that tells me that we need to reevaluate why are so many people being arrested under those circumstances or being issued warrants under those circumstances or held in jail under those circumstances. And is it necessary to do any of those three things?
But these shifts and the slowdown in court proceedings still haven't meaningfully reduced the caseload for the Missouri State Public Defender System.
And when you, as a taxpayer, are thinking about that, think in terms of if you or your loved one needed a public defender, you would want it to be an attorney from the public defender system who had the time to spend on your case and to prepare it well so that you got not just your day in court, but your day in court with an attorney who was able and willing to represent you.
Fox explains that this overwhelming caseload is preventable.
But a significant number of the cases that come to our attention where we're asked to represent someone, the cases are eventually dismissed. So I think the first thing we have to ask ourselves is there a reason to even have this case? Is this a charge that needs to be charged against this person? Is there sufficient evidence? Did we do a thorough investigation before we locked this person up? We had a client who was charged with a robbery, and it was at one of the store, a store that had a videotape. And when the videotape was received and turned over to the prosecutor, the charge remained. When the videotape was turned over to the defense attorney looked at it and saw that the person had never taken anything. There was no robbery. And in fact, the only violence that had occurred, and robbery is taking something by force, is when a security guard tackled the person who was now the defendant. So if the prosecutor had waited before filing that charge to look at the videotape and see if they really did have a charge against the person, they would have saved the cost of incarcerating that person, the cost of providing prosecution services in that case, the cost of providing defense services in that case, and the personal cost to that person who spent, I think, 6 months in jail prior to the case being dismissed. Just relying on the word of a police officer in the heat of the moment coming in where they may be upset at some person without doing further investigation results in cases being charged that do not need to be charged.
And Fox says prosecutors and police also have the power to reduce the number of people who are charged and incarcerated by arresting people as a last resort and connecting people to resources and services first.
So if you have someone who is homeless and who is, let's say, urinating in public, that's a crime. Do we really lock that person up? Or do we go to that person and say, you know, what can we do to assist you? Are you interested in services? Can we provide you with some services? And don't lock them up. What is the value of locking that person up? And obviously that's a very low-level crime, but it's those low-level crimes that often bring people first into contact with the criminal justice system and then keep them in contact with the criminal justice system. Somebody like that could receive a fine and then be unable to pay the fine and end up being incarcerated over and over again.
Fox argues that an overemphasis on incarceration not only has dire consequences for the public's well-being and constitutional rights, but also sets society back, socially and economically.
We're driving ourselves broke. The cost of incarceration is horrible to not just the government, but also to the community. So every person who is locked up, they're not contributing to their community while they're locked up. They don't have a job. They're not caring for their children, so often the care of the children is forced upon the state. They're not getting an education so that they can improve themselves and come back and contribute to their community. So if we just continue to incarcerate people, we are removing an entire set of our community and not giving them a way to return and be productive members.
the city of St. Louis has received significant public and legal pressure from organizers, advocates, and civil rights organizations to close its medium security institution, or the workhouse. And in each year following the start of the Close the Workhouse campaign, the number of people detained in the workhouse has declined by at least 100. But after investing $5.5 million in renovations and changes, the current administration of the city of St. Louis has touted the workhouse for being clean, transformed, and professionally run. We asked St. Louis City Mayor Lyda Crewson's office to respond to concerns brought up by decarceration advocates and those who are incarcerated. They referred us to Judge Jimmy Edwards, the Director of Public Safety for the City of St. Louis, who served as a St. Louis Circuit Judge since 1992, before assuming his current role in 2017. We started by asking him to respond to complaints about the lack of access to hand sanitizer and soap in St. Louis City jails, especially for people who are poor. Edwards explained that the City of St. Louis implemented a COVID-19 response on March 18th with a policy of free canteen items starting in the last week of April.
We have a COVID-19 response, and our COVID-19 response includes free canteen, which means that everything inside of both of our jails, you want to talk specifically with respect to MSI, everything is free, whether it's soap, whether it's hand sanitizer, Clorox wipes, all of those things are free for them personally and individually. Moreover, all of those products are made available for them to utilize, including foggers, if they want to clean out their cells.
He addressed concerns over CDC guidelines for social distancing by explaining that people are held individually at the St. Louis City Medium Security Institution, and that visits from people outside of the jail are now prohibited.
Everyone that's housed at MSI is housed in a single cell. So there are no two people's cells at MSI. So they all have a single cell to encourage social distancing and things of that sort. I implemented a no-contact plan for those folk that are detained inside the MSI. So nobody in can come in and be around the detainees. As a result of that, all telephone calls to their loved ones are also free. And so what we've done is we have made it comfortable as it could possibly be without charging our detainees for telephone calls, for soap, for wipes, for hand sanitizer, for anything that they might need to make sure that their area is clean. And we encourage them to do that. In addition to that, we have hired many of the detainees to help us sanitize and to disinfect. And so those folk are disinfecting at least three times a day at a minimum, all of the areas that folk are touching, whether they're doorknobs, whether they're handles, whether they're walls, things of those types. And so the information that you've received is just absolutely not true.
The stories recorded in late March and published in mid-April include accounts of blood and mucus on cell walls and mold in the showers. Edwards said he received information about those conditions in 2012 when he was serving as a judge, but disputed that these conditions exist today.
I think that may have happened. That may have happened in 2012. And then, of course, as years pass, and as we continue to go on, those things get embellished to black mold, on and on and on. I can tell you with a great deal of confidence that those types of things have not existed in the medium security institution since 2017, since I have been here, and I have made visits to the medium security institution, and I've invited the media there on several occasions to look for themselves.
We inquired about concerns over correctional officers bringing coronavirus from the outside into the close quarters of the St. Louis City Medium Security Institution, including stories from people who are incarcerated about correctional officers not always wearing masks or gloves to prevent the spread, with some even going to work with high temperatures. Edwards responded that when COVID-19 protocols were implemented on March 19th, that included a requirement for correctional officers to wear masks and gloves.
To have masks and gloves Those are protocols, part of our protocol with respect to correction officers. And it is my expectation that they all are there. I can tell you that we've not had a single positive case among our inmate population. We just haven't had a positive case. And a lot of that is certainly by the grace of God. But I do expect for those folk that are working, that are coming in contact in any way, there should only be workers coming in contact with our detainees, will don a mask, will have their gloves on, and will respond in kind, will respond in accordance with CDC guidelines, and they will comply with the COVID-19 protocols that we have implemented for MSI.
And he explained that in the event that a correctional officer does receive a positive test for COVID-19, there are certain protocols that must be followed before officers can return to work.
We've had two positive cases among our correction officers. Neither of those correction officers had any direct contact with any of our detainees. But even though they had no direct contact with either of our detainees, if they worked in the same area of our detainees, we would isolate those detainees. They would go into quarantine for 14 days. And right after the 14-day quarantine, they would have been tested for COVID-19. And that protocol happened in our facility about a month ago. And those folk that were tested all tested negative for COVID-19. You don't have to have positive for us to invite you to leave our facility. If you are sick, we expect for you not to come to work. This has been our practice for many, many years. So COVID has only highlighted what we believe should be the practice, irrespective of circumstances.
We asked how the City of St. Louis is ensuring that there are adequate amounts of personal protective equipment for correctional officers.
Well, I think that I have about 80,000 masks in our facility. We have gloves, we have gowns, we have face shields, we have shoes, we have those things in our facility.
The facility he's referring to is the St. Louis City Justice Center, a newer jail that was opened in 2002. And we followed up by asking if any personal protective equipment is being allocated for people who are incarcerated.
Our detainees are not permitted outside of their cells without a mask, without PPE. They just simply ask for it. Yeah, unlike most facilities, our detainees have access walking up and down halls. They're not all locked in a cell. It's not congregate living, but they have the ability to walk around. They are not in any type of secure confinement all day long. And so just as hand sanitizers are available at a desk, or wipes are available at a desk, masks are also available for our detainees at any time they would like them. So they are not given one or two masks and expected that they should hold on to those one or two masks for a week or 2 weeks. If they would like two or three masks a day, and for whatever reason, they don't have the original mask or the original two or three masks, we don't question that. So it's the liberal distribution of whatever the detainees need to keep them safe.
But in the event that someone who is incarcerated does contract the virus, Edwards explains that healthcare is handled inside St. Louis City jails, and the City of St. Louis relies on contracts with St. Louis University and Washington University in St. Louis hospitals to handle more severe cases that require a ventilator and intubation.
Well, we have a healthcare facility, a full-blown healthcare facility inside of our jail that has the capacity to address those types of health issues. And so you have to keep in mind that we have dealt with communicable diseases for a long, long time, whether it's been TB, whether it's been HIV, whether it's been SARS, or whether it's been anything else. Those people have been locked up too. And we have the capacity to treat those people, to address those folk. I suspect that we do have ventilators Yeah, but I think that if we have to intubate, if it gets very, very seriously, I don't expect that our healthcare staff will be doing that. I would want them at a level one trauma type center. You know, we're not going to risk not having all of the necessary equipment to make sure that we protect folk.
We asked Edwards about his thoughts on decarceration as a way to reduce the spread of COVID-19.
We have released nearly 300 people from our facilities in the last 2 months. And the 300 people that have been released from our facilities have ranged from low-level felonies all the way up to murder first degree and everything included in the middle. And so whether it's a rape case, a robbery case, a carjacking case, a murder case, drug cases, those people have been released, notwithstanding some of the reporting that we have heard. So we are surpassing 300 now. Currently, there are a little over 100, maybe 110 folk at MSI. I haven't checked the numbers this morning, but all of those folk are in the single rooms. And so the idea here is to impress upon them that they have to be socially distant, that they have to wash their hands, and that they have to utilize the PPEs that we have provided. And I think to a large degree is the reason that our detainees have been largely healthy. We've not had any health issues inside either of our jails. Certainly we have not had anyone to suffer any symptoms with respect to COVID-19. I do have testing capacity at this time. And so I expect that we will test everybody inside of the facility just out of a great abundance of caution, notwithstanding the fact that we have no one that's symptomatic. But I understand that you can have COVID and be asymptomatic. And so one of the things that we want to do is to get out in front of that, and so that we can address it in a way that is reasonable and very, very humanely. So what we have inside of our facility in terms as a part of our COVID protocol, we have isolation rooms. We have negative air rooms. We have the ability to isolate and to take care of all of the detainees that we have inside of our jails.
Edwards explained that decarceration involves various parts of the criminal justice system, with positions that have the discretion and authority over who is and isn't incarcerated.
The city of St. Louis is just the jailer. The judge is the only one that can release anyone from jail. And so oftentimes it's the judge together with the defense attorney and the prosecutor. So when people are locked up, they're locked up not because I want them locked up or not because the city wants them locked up. They're locked up because of the court system. We are just one very small piece of this puzzle in this long, precarious, complex criminal justice scenario. We have no authority. We have no discretion. And so the arguments ought to be directed not at the city, but at the judge. The argument should not be directed at the city, but at the prosecutor. The argument should not be directed at the city, but at the public defender. Those are the folk that make the final decision with respect to how many people are incarcerated in the city of St. Louis, not the city of St. Louis. We're just the landlord.
But advocates with the Close the Workhouse campaign point out that the city of St. Louis has been spending around $16 million annually to operate the workhouse. And even though the number of people incarcerated at the workhouse has declined to the point that the city of St. Louis's proposed budget for fiscal year 2021 now allocates a little over $9 million to the medium security institution, they say that these cuts don't go far enough and the money could be better spent elsewhere.
You know, certainly I understand the advocacy. I understand, you know, the people that believe that just the mere mention of the workhouse brings up just terrible issues. I mean, slaves were sold at the old courthouse. Dred Scott couldn't get his freedom. in 1857. I understand all of that. But there's no advocacy to tear down the old courthouse. There's no advocacy to do a lot of things. Listen, this is a problem. I would like to one day reach a point where we don't need jails. I would like to get there. We are certainly not there yet. Perhaps we can do better in terms of how we incarcerate people. Maybe we can have some reforms, but we're certainly not there yet. I have 56 homicides today. Since COVID, we've made over 1,800 arrests. This is still a problem in our city. Until we're able to address the underlying issues with respect to crime, all of the other social justice issues, which I'm surprised that people, you know, are so interested in this workhouse issue, where we have these other issues or reasons that are leading people to incarceration, education, poverty, housing, just being treated fairly, the discrimination, the ability of not being included, housing and being hungry. Those are all of the underlying social issues that I just don't hear people arguing about or people protesting about. I mean, I think that if we can get there, we can stop it on the back end. And so jail's on the back end. Jail is on the back end. You know, what's going to eliminate and eradicate this issue with criminal justice, what's going to really give us real reform in criminal justice, it's all the things that are on the front end.
It seems that even though Edwards and the city of St. Louis continue to focus on reforms in a system that requires incarceration, while advocates for decarceration are pushing for a larger overhaul of the criminal justice system that involves closing jails, they agree that the front-end issues, such as housing, education, and economic opportunity, need to be addressed. A report released in January by the Close the Workhouse campaign suggests that the money spent to operate St. Louis's medium security institution could be reallocated through participatory budgeting, and they propose priorities such as affordable housing and community-based mental and addiction health care. But at the center of the debate over whether to improve conditions for people who are incarcerated, release people from jails, prisons, and detention facilities, or close jails down altogether, are concerns over public safety. So we asked Edwards to define what public safety means to him.
When people talk to me about public safety, you know, I often think, and I'm very hopeful, that we have the ability to all come together to do what's in the best interest. And so, what's in our best interest? That is that we don't fear each other. You know, you're not afraid when you see three African-American men walking down the street in front of you, or that you feel comfortable that your children or that the people that you love and care about can go anywhere in our city and be safe and don't have the stressors that something might happen to them that they don't want.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. This show is overseen by Tim Lloyd, Senior Producer of On Demand and Content Partnerships, and Robert Peterson, Director of Radio Programming and Operations at St. Louis Public Radio. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.